Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves is over, but we're just getting started here on Post Show Recaps Theater. My name is Grace, and I usually have my typical co-host here with me, but I believe he's been incapacitated by a red wizard, so unable to join us. Instead, I'm joined by a person who knows Dungeons & Dragons all too well. It's DM Philly. Philly, how you doing?
I'm so good. I'm really upset that you could see through my disguise self spell, though. Bad casting. Yeah.
Yeah. Your face is morphing. I guess. I'm poking holes in your. Yeah. You're not Ariel at all.
No. Nope.
Yeah.
My illusion is like skipped off. Thank you so much for having me, though, Grace. I'm so excited to get to be here and try to play the role. I will role play Ariel today as best I can. I'm really excited to chat with you about this.
No, maybe this is just Ariel's character died, and this is the new character we're rolling up into the party.
This is kind of it. It's the quest. Yeah. We need the stone. Yeah,
that's right. Rich, you are a longtime fan of Dungeons & Dragons, as people who are listening will know. I am excited to chat with you about this iteration of the Dungeons & Dragons movie, this movie that is on movie theater screens. Make sure you subscribe, postrecaps.com/movies. Rich, what'd you think? I know it's no spoilers, but what'd you think? Yeah.
No spoilers.
We'll get into a spoiler section. Yeah.
Right. Just for context, right? Like I'm at 32 years that I've been playing Dungeons and Dragons at this point, Grace, which is probably older than like half the people listening to this.
Do you say 32 years?
Yes.
I turn 32 later this year, Rich.
Yeah, there you go. I have been, Dungeons & Dragons is such an integral part of my life. I grew up with it. It has informed the way that I look at media. Half the movies that are even remotely fantasy adjacent that I have watched in the subsequent 32 years, I'm always looking at through the D&D lens. And you did mention these previous iterations. I was a hardcore, devoted, full-time Dungeons & Dragons player when the first two films came out in the early 2000s, and they were disastrously, unironically, unenjoyably bad. Jeremy Irons was delightful, but so to have a film that I enjoyed as much as this, it's a gift, Grace. It is the treasure at the end of my 32-year quest. I love this movie. It was very, very fun. It did not hit all of my particular tastes, but I thought it did such a good job conveying the ridiculousness and the disproportionate seriousness that simultaneously exists in a session of D&D with your friends.
Yeah, I think that is really accurate. I think to the point of it, like, this is basically a venue to make a comedy movie, essentially.
Yes.
And I think that the comedy actually works really well. And the thing I keep saying is that I think that the people who play D&D in my life who went to go see this movie very much enjoyed it, liked it. There are a ton of, I don't know, the world is just full of, you know, the Faerun lore that if you play with that stuff, then like it's there. And I think almost every minute of the movie, you can be like, oh, that's a thing. I know that's a thing. That's a thing. That's a thing. Like, I think that, so it's there for the people who love D&D somehow without being, like, I don't know, like hitting you over the head that it's a D&D movie in a way. Like I feel like people who don't like D&D will also like this movie, because I don't think you need to be a fan of D&D to enjoy this movie.
It's really soft, passive world building. It kind of reminded me of the early Star Wars films in the way that it's laying down all this lore without putting an overemphasis on the idea that you need to remember all these details. It does not matter if you know that they're in Neverwinter or not. It does not matter if you have the context of the Icewind Dale or the Red Wizards of Thay. But the way that they layered all this stuff in was really rich and rewarding. And when you talk about the Forgotten Realms, you know, Dungeons & Dragons, part of its success over the decades is that you could sit down with a group of friends and you can all build your world together. Right. You are not beholden to George Martin's idea of fantasy or J.R.R. Tolkien's idea of fantasy. You can create your own venue for that. But part of the widespread appeal of the game is that there are these kind of communal places that we play in. And the Forgotten Realms is a campaign setting that was released in the kind of mid-80s and is the home of Faerun. And it's the common ground that most modern D&D players play in. I'm a professional dungeon master, Grace. I work with clients who hire me to teach them and their friends how to play. And I often have this conversation of, do you want to play in Faerun? It's the world where when you go out to the movie theater to see the D&D movie, you're going to be able to like connect with other people that know this lore and resonate with it. Even in the PSR Discord. We obviously have our big, thriving, sprawling D&D campaign that we launched when the Discord started. And it's set right on the edge of the Kingdom of Fae. So the fact that, like, we get this touch, no spoilers, but, like, the Red Wizards, this kind of lore, it was really fulfilling personally for me to reflect on how many people I have introduced this world to. Right. It's like I sat them down to watch the first episode of Game of Thrones and watched them fall in love. So to share that with so many people and to see the kind of the like widespread appeal that this film has already so quickly, it just fills my heart with love and satisfaction and makes me feel like maybe I haven't wasted the last 32 years, Grace.
Fair enough. But I mean, I just think there was a balance to the film that I don't know that everything that has such a deep lore, like if you try to make something that has as much lore as Dungeons and Dragons, I think it's tricky to make sure that it does not feel like you're overwhelming the audience to have to know all these things. I feel like there was a feeling coming out of Dune last year that a lot of people had. I loved Dune, and I loved how much it made you sit in the world without necessarily explaining what everything meant. Yep. And, I think part of that is that it does use, you know, that's a world that I think people are a little bit less familiar with, even if it's even if it is like a very popular fantasy series. But there was a way in which I think some people came out of Dune being like, I feel dumb and I don't know that I liked that. Yes. In a way that I don't think that this movie does. I think part of it is that D&D is so steeped in the Lord of the Rings lore, right? Like it takes a lot from that, which has become so synonymous with like fantasy. So I just wonder if and then also D&D, despite it being niche, I think it's like really blown up in the last, you know, 7-ish years. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of a lot of D&D language, I think, does like translate if you've watched a lot of
well, it's ubiquitous, Grace. Right. Like, we now have grown up, you know, Dungeons and Dragons is approaching its 50th year anniversary. It has been around longer than people kind of take into account. And at the end of the day, so many of the mechanical systems that were designed to make the game work, the actual game itself, right, the rules have been extrapolated into the video games that we've been playing ever since, and the kind of other fantasy fiction that has been told afterwards, in the same way that Star Wars inspired like generations of people to go out and pursue careers in art and science and medicine and all of these different fields. Dungeons and Dragons has kind of done the same thing. And I think that in the way that like Tolkien influenced D&D in those early days, they took so much from his work, but they pulled from a lot of lesser known fantasy works and authors of the time. And they kind of churned it up into this blender mishmash of like a fantasy setting that has now been kind of recontextualized again and again and again in so much of the fantasy media that we take in. We're early in the podcast, Grace. I'm contractually obligated to mention it, but within the last year, the Willow series aired on Disney Plus, and I felt that it was so bold in the way that it kind of existed with a similar tone to Honor Among Thieves. It was irreverent. It kind of broke the fourth wall. There was a little bit of eye winking to you as the audience of like, we know that you're an audience watching this fantasy show, and this is super fun. And a little bit of what we're going to do together is poke fun at how serious we all take this and wink and nod to each other. And I loved it unabashedly. So I think for folks who love this film and want more, that's like a natural kind of follow-up to it. But I love the tone, the irreverence, the humor, and the way that the humor worked without making me as a lifetime D&D player feel dumb for taking this stuff so seriously, right? Mm-hmm. It was good-natured. It's fun. They were laughing with me, not at me. And that's like so important to the kind of tone that they were playing with, I think.
So we'll jump into it. I think the movie did have a successful opening weekend. It made $35 or $38 million domestically. It's made about $70 million collectively, internationally and domestically. It did cost about $150 million to make. And I do think the thing I was worried about, that it comes a week after John Wick. It is able to beat John Wick at the box office, which I actually was a little surprised whether or not it was going to do. They're not the same, but they are the same. If that makes, like, I think that if you're looking, I mean, the one thing I think about D&D was that I saw kids in the theater, and if you brought a child to see John Wick, I question your choices. I guess I don't really care if you bring your child to John Wick, but boy, interesting, you know. So that's exciting, although I will say tough that it's going to come out just before an early release of Mario due to Easter weekend. So I think that that's a really good weekend. It's probably its only weekend at the top of the box office, but I would love for this movie to make money because I would like them to do more. There's so much opportunity just in the stuff that I saw of like what else we could, like I said to you, Rich, I think I want every module made. Like, give me Dungeons and Dragons, Curse of Strahd. Give me Dungeons and Dragons, you know, Storm King's Thunder. Give me them all. I want it all. There's some things we didn't see in this movie that I want to see. So yeah.
It's so interesting. I do think the John Wick battle is really impressive, right? Because they're both like established franchises in a way, but John Wick is so much more mainstream, right? And cool and popular in that kind of way. But I feel what you're saying, that they're both these strange genre products. Just to like look back to these other past D&D movies, part of the disastrous failure about them was that they were generic. They did not lock us into a familiar place that people know in D&D. They did not use necessarily familiar characters. The way that the magic systems were presented in the film did not align with the kind of rules of the game, right? So it all felt like foreign.
Talk about that with Honor Among Thieves, but I have no problem with it. But we'll talk about the way magic was used.
We certainly will. But yeah. It did, it just in a way, like put this very generic label of like, you know, D+ fantasy movie, and let's just put the ampersand and add another D and call it a D&D movie. And it never fit. So to the point of like all the lore and setting it in this familiar world, I think was like so successful. And it's a smart decision. It connected us with that place without being overwhelming or daunting in that way. And it really just, you know, the camaraderie of the ensemble. I mean, at the end of the day, sitting down to play Dungeons and Dragons with your friends, it's about spending a couple of hours with the people who you enjoy company with and telling stories. You're sitting around a table talking.
I feel like that's what the movie did, you know? So
it did. It captured that vibe of friends and found family that is so instrumental to so many D&D games. And I think it really opens them up for a lot of potential. There have been kind of countless novels of varying degrees of success written in the worlds of Dungeons and Dragons. There are all the actual adventures, the modules that you're talking about, that are these great opportunities to return to the world. They could go in 1,000 different directions and turn this into a big sprawling IP if they wanted to. And
probably
and
we'll do the modules because it kind of spoils the modules, right? But alas. All right. Well, let me spill the PSRG. I mean, we usually at the end of this do stream it or skip it. I think both of us agree. It's very fun. You should go see it. Watch it on the big screen if you feel comfortable doing so and financially can do so. If not, it'll be very fun when it comes to streaming. I'm sure we'll stream it in the Discord. So you should become a patron. patreon.com/postshowrecaps. So let me spill the PSRT. I'll recap the movie and then Richie and I can talk about whatever we want from the movie. So we meet a bard, Ejin Darvis, story played by Chris Pine, and a barbarian named Holga, played by Michelle Rodriguez, and they are imprisoned in Icewind Dale. While sort of making his plea to be freed, though without our beloved Eric Coker, Jonathan.
Jonathan?
That was, I mean, the first joke for me is that, like, yeah, of course, like the DM, that's either a name that the DM had to come up with on the spot, or a player kept calling him Jonathan instead of Jonathan, and that became the Eric Coker's name. but while making their plea to be freed, Ejin explains that he spent years as a member of the Harpers, an order of peacekeepers, until his wife was killed by a red wizard. Ejin and Holga tried to make a new life for themselves, raising the daughter Kira sort of together as like a brother, sister, aunt, and uncle thing. He turned to theft, forming a team with a sorcerer, Simon, played by Justice Smith, and a rogue, Forge, played by Hugh Grant. However, while raiding a Harper stronghold, they end up getting captured due to a time stop spell. They're also trying to do this with Sophina, played by Daisy Head. and they are captured when he tried to steal a tablet of resurrection to raise his wife from the dead. When they escape prison, they learn that Forge has become the Lord of Neverwinter, and the previous Lord has become incapacitated. Forge has been taking care of Kira and essentially gaslighted her, convinced her that he was trying to steal a tablet of enrichment instead, and left her for his own selfish means. Sophia is revealed to be a Red Wizard of Thay. Sophia tries to have Edgin and Holga executed, but they escape. They decide they will steal from Forge's vault and take back Kira during the High Sun Games, sort of a festival that has been reinstated by Forge. The two track down Simon and recruit a druid named Doric, played by Sophia Lillis. Using her wild shape abilities, Doric learns that the vault door is using the magical defenses of Mordenkainen, and they'll need the Helm of Disjunction to break it. They travel to a graveyard in the Evermoors and learn it is held by Paladin Zenk Yandar, played by Regé-Jean Page. Zenk fled Thay when the Red Wizards turned his people into an undead army, and he is trying to seek vengeance on them. Zenk agrees to help Edgin only if he distributes all the wealth from the vault to the citizens of Neverwinter. Holga goes home, and to get some of her stuff, she finds out that her ex-husband, Marlamin, hilariously played by Bradley Cooper, has moved on, and she takes back her stuff, including a staff that they learn is a staff of teleportation. They go into the Underdark to retrieve the helm and escape from a dragon and finally retrieve the helm. But Simon has trouble attuning to the helm, so they use the staff to enter the vault instead. Simon and Holga get in, but find it to be empty. The entire group is captured and forced to compete in the games. When they escape, Doric learns that Forge has loaded all the treasure on a boat, so the group steals the boat, rescues Kira, but ultimately decide to turn back when they realize that Sofina is going to turn all of the citizens of Neverwinter into an undead army. They redistribute the wealth by using the teleportation circle to essentially like litter gold and treasure all over the city. People leave the arena, and Sofina's plan does not work. They end up fighting her. Simon ends up being able to use a counter spell. His magic is finally good enough to be able to stop her. Kira uses an invisibility pendant she's had for a long time to put Sophina in magic, in anti-magic cuffs. And then Doric then crushes her as an owlbear. Holga is fatally injured, but they use the Tablet of Resurrection on her instead of his ex-wife, his dead wife. Doric implies that she'd be open to a relationship with Simon, and the old Lord of Neverwinter wakes up, declares the party heroes of the city, and sends Forge to prison in Icewind Dale. And that's Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves. Where should we start, Rich? What's the headline? Gosh,
there's so much stuff. I don't even know what the headline is. I just want to stop down and say, across this 32 years of my time with Dungeons & Dragons, the Harpers, once upon a time, were the coolest secret organization in the world, Grace. And the fact
Shout out to Antonio Mazzaro, who famously plays a Harper, I believe, right? No, Yeah, he does, right?
Indeed, he does. Yeah. Yes, he is a Harper bard, nonetheless.
Right. There you go.
Getting like those connections when you talk about the cool lore. Listen, there's part of me that's always going to like recoil a little bit at anybody else telling the story. It is the OCD dungeon master in me, Grace, and the notion that like they didn't make the Harpers as cool as they needed to be. But the fact that the like lead of our ensemble here is a Harper, and it's about this redemption arc and this whole story that ultimately leads in the end to this notion that I think we can very clearly look at the movie of like the player characters of our main ensemble and the non-player characters, right?
Yeah.
And Edgin's dead wife is a non-player character, and he's got this motivation from his backstory before he even starts the campaign.
Classic sad backstory.
Exactly. Routine. It's a wonderfully tragic backstory. It's very
good.
I like that we get the turn at the end that, he stole the Red Wizard's gold. This is a callback to like some very old second edition D&D magic that would do stuff like that. But the fact that we get this whole evolution to, no, in the end, you're going to get all these things that you needed only to realize that like part of what it is to be a Harper is like you're going to use this resurrection for your friend, for this other player character that you have spent all this time with and been through this journey with. And this backstory was unimportant. This is a tiny little thing, but gosh, it made the conclusion so much more satisfying for me than it would have been. I enjoyed the film. I was having a good time, but that was like the emotional like bang at the end that made me like, I really like this movie and I like what they did with the story.
Yeah. Essentially, Edgin and Holga are sort of like the two, they're really like the main characters of this movie.
Yes.
And then Simon and Doric are like also in the party. Like one thing I think you could do with this movie is that, like, you know, you could have another movie where like we explore their backstories a little bit more than we did. Cause really the other two get the main focus. What I think is so quintessential about D&D, I was actually talking to every Monday at work, I have this, this call that's just my department. It's just a like hang and chill coffee chat. You're not supposed to talk about work. So I was talking about D&D, and someone was like, and I was talking about how, you know, the thing I love about D&D is that you can do anything. You learn that you can do anything. And they were like, well, how did they put that in the video game that you could just do anything? It's like, oh yeah, you really don't understand how D&D works. But then I tried to give the essence of D&D, and then I was saying that I feel like the movie hit the tone really well in that there is like a tragic backstory. There's like a thing that clearly they need to do. But then also, it's like most of the movie, as I said, it's like mostly a comedy. It's very funny. I think that the scene where they, I know this was released as a trailer, although we get like sort of an extended version of it, but when they cast Speak with Dead, where you can ask 5 questions of a dead person, I thought it was so, like, that scene is so funny, even though I'd seen it in the trailer, of like them being like, doesn't it count as a question? And this guy's like, the skeleton's like, yes, it does. And
you know how many times I've actually done that?
Yeah, Grace? I know.
Just my favorite. It was so delightful.
So funny. It's so funny. And so that to me just had the most like D&D energy-ness of like, you go in thinking, I think when you play D&D, it's like a very much a game where you're like going to be a hero. And then most of the time it's so silly. And because you're just playing with your friends, right? And you're like goofing around. And that's how my experience of D&D has been, right? And then weirdly, because, and this is the thing I say all the time about like good comedies, like are like have dramatic moments, and good dramas are funny. And I do think that like the sort of silliness and whimsiness, you kind of get caught up as you're like hanging out with your friends. You're like, then a battle happens and you're like, oh my God, Holg is down to 0 points and is like unconscious and maybe just rolled 3 to failed death saving throws. And so then, yeah, you use your revivify on your friend. Like it's the thing where the dramatic moments of a D&D game can like hit you so hard because you like, I think most of the energy when I play is, you know, we joke about like, you know, we play on your D&D stream of like whimsy, it's whimsical.
Yes. Yes.
Until it's not, until it gets very serious. Cause D&D is a game mostly based around combat. And so I thought the movie just nailed that tone. I think that they made a really smart decision to not super try to adhere to, like, do you want to talk about the wild shape scene, Rich?
Yes, let's talk about the wild shape, right? So
what level must Doric be to be able to wild shape 7 times in a minute?
It's really funny. This is one of these things where there's part of me, I'm so hardcore in D&D, Grace. I'm like too far down the rabbit hole for my own good sometimes. So once upon a time, I don't mean to give a history lesson, druids used to be able to wild shape much more frequently than they can now. By the rules of 5th edition, you get 2 and then you need a rest for an hour, right?
Yeah.
So there's this like real misalignment, like the depiction that we see of Doric does not align with the rules, but it was really cool, right? It's the rule of cool that we talk about in D&D, where if the dungeon master is like, look, like this is just our group, because it's not a video game, like the rules printed in the book need to be kind of standardized for anybody, and they need to be written such that they're taking into account that one guy who wants to like leverage the exception and kind of abuse the mechanics, as it were. And most often you don't have that one guy at your table because you're hanging out with your friends, right? So I love the crazy wild shaping, but yes, our dear mutual friend Melissa Woodward, a huge fan of druids, was like, I do feel bad for all the brand new players that are going to go make druids after this and have their dungeon masters be like, oh, I'm sorry, no, you can't become an owl bear, that is not a beast. Oh,
you can do it twice for a maximum of 1 hour at the start.
Exactly. You turned into a fly and now you're a deer. Good luck.
Unless you're very powerful, unless you're very high level, but that takes a fair bit of time. Unless your DM just levels you up rather quickly. But
nonetheless, though, it, like
homebrew. Was this a homebrew rule, Rich?
Yes, it is. Really, like to me, part of what I loved about it is there were all these elements of the film, Grace, that harkened back to older editions of D&D that I don't know that like so much of the audience would have caught that I absolutely adored, right? We get the crazy cameo of the 80s D&D heroes at the end, the actual characters from the Once Upon a Time animated series that I grew up with on Saturday mornings in the early 80s. Even like the point where they get onto the wagon with the treasure, and it's like this battle wagon, right? It's got all this steel plating on the outside. Grace, we used to build these in every campaign that we played because half the adventure was getting the treasure back to town, and everybody would try to steal it from you, right? So there were all of these little beats, the ship at the end, the armored ship that like really called back to the Once Upon a Time. For the old graybeard D&D nerd sitting in the audience, there was like an extra layer of depth there, and that drew it wild shaping and wild shaping and wild shaping again. Like, I kind of loved it because it reminded me of the druids of like 20 years ago that I used to roll with.
I thought there's a thing in D&D called the rule of cool. It's like not a real thing, but essentially it's like sometimes your DM, like you ask your DM if you can do something and they're like, yeah, and you do it because it's cool, because you're telling a story together, and like you don't always need to adhere 100% to the rules.
Especially so, Grace, because it's cinematic, right? This is like such a magic word that we look for when we tell these stories. Yeah,
so I do feel like there's a lot of that. I thought very interestingly, like Edgin as the bard never does any magic. Like bards have magic in 5e, but he definitely doesn't do any magic. He doesn't even really fight that much. He plays his guitar a couple of times, but it's really they really keep the magic to the two magic users, and even then it's really the sorcerer and the wizard who are like mostly using magic, whereas like, you know, Holga as a barbarian is also like, you know, not do, you know, but it was just, I thought it was very interesting that like really Edgin doesn't really do any fight. Like he doesn't fight really in this. He's said as the guy who makes the plans, comes up with the plans, and the plans fail. Therefore he's a man who makes plans who fails.
It's really interesting, right? Because the bard has become such a popular class in fifth edition now, and the fact that they don't necessarily lean into all of the actual class mechanics, it's clear like they wanted to create some clear archetypes for us, right? And make it really clear, let like the certain characters own certain roles in the kind of group and in the ensemble. I love the little beat that like when they go to break into the Harper stronghold in the beginning, he's got like his combat armor on, Grace, little stuff like that. But again, like in the olden days of D&D, the bard was this jack of all trades. They used to have a much higher intelligence score than they do nowadays. And I love the idea that he is the leader of the party, you know, part of his role. And it's so instrumental in that beat where he talks to them about like, the minute we become too afraid of failing to fail is when we fail, right? Yeah. It's such a like ridiculous, like, collection of words that is a really like poignant sentiment, and the fact that like he's there to do that, that's him being the bard, that's the bardic inspiration, that's like that charisma and that leadership, the little bit of like I'm the guy that makes plans. Again, it harkened back to me of like the bards of the days of yore who were not as much like powerhouse spellcasters as a fifth edition bard is, and they had to like survive by their own wits. Something I love about like so many of the fantasy movies from the 80s is like often the protagonist is this scrappy rogue kind of character. And I think as we like moved along through fantasy, especially in the venue of Dungeons and Dragons, in a world where Critical Role exists and Sam Riegel is like so many people's favorite player, the bard is like beloved and so many people want to play that role to like capture this kind of energy. Right. Mm-hmm. Of like the swaggering, charming, like witty. I'm just kind of arrogant enough to believe in my own ridiculous plans and to believe in your abilities, even though it's a little ridiculous to me. It was really fun.
Yeah. I mean, he has this moment with Simon when Simon gets mad because he can't attune to the helmet. And he's like, you told me not to tell anybody. And they're like, what the hell? Why'd you? And he's like, because I actually did think you might be able to attune to the helmet. Like, I just like, I thought you couldn't do it now, but you would like figure it out eventually, you know? What do you think of the attunement storyline that Simon can't attune to the helmet until he does by like like fighting his grandfather, his great-great-grandfather. Yeah,
really interesting. So Simon's great-great-grandfather is one of the most popular characters across all of Dungeons & Dragons kind of fiction. Elminster Amontour, it was really cool to get that little thread and that connection. Simon is this wild magic sorcerer. Wild magic is supposed to be this erratic, unpredictable thing, you know? The distinction between him and our red wizards, the wizards study and learn and perfect their spells through memorizing them out of books, and Simon is this natural ability. So I don't necessarily, attunement's not a fifth edition rule that I love, as you know well, Grace, this idea that you can only have a certain number of magical items that you're attached to. But I love the way they used it here, that he can't like activate the thing until the pressure's on, right? And Edgin like will later be talking about, dude, I watched you cast reverse gravity in an entire theater full of people. This is one of these things that you're talking about, where if you're an in-the-know D&D player, you know reverse gravity is an 8th-level spell. It doesn't get much more powerful than that. If this kid can do that, why can't he use the helm? You know? So it created this really fun moment. And I just love the opportunity to get to see Elminster walk onto a screen in live action. That was really fun.
Yeah. I think the attunement thing for me, I did like it as well in terms of a story beat. It's not how attunement for me has worked in any of my home games. And really, attunement is there basically so that if you have like a magic, you know, pendant or something, you can't just like give it to the next person to go, and you know, it's to like stop kind of like the passing around.
It's a design balance element. In the like previous edition of D&D, not the previous one, but in third edition, there was a world where you ended up with a lot of magic items, and we used to joke that a character by the time they're 10th level is like a Christmas tree when you cast detect magic, that they're glowing, right? And fifth edition is just mechanically designed to be more balanced and even across the board. It's part of why it's been so successful in the last 10 years. And part of that is being like, everybody can only use 3 magic items. That's it. Let's like keep it even, you know?
Yeah. But I did like how they use it as a story beat for Simon. Again, I feel like, you know, we did get a little bit of like Simon's history, but not even really. I mean, there's the one scene where he's confronted by his great grandfather, but other than that, and then him and Doric by the end, like he's asked out Doric and she said no before, and then by the end of the movie she's like maybe. What'd you make of like these two? They kind of round out our party, and as I said, I feel like, you know, Chris Pine and Michelle Rodriguez get the bulk of the, you know, emotional weight of this movie. What'd you make of these other two?
So look, druids are one of my all-time absolute favorite classes. They're the best. It's awesome to get a druid. The fact that she's connected to the Emerald Enclave was super cool. This is, again, that Forgotten Realms lore that a lot of people wouldn't connect with, but it's one of these secret organizations of like tree-hugging hippies that are fighting the good fight out there, and I love that little thread. The fact that she's a tiefling is really, really neat, Grace.
Yeah, that was interesting.
This is not like a natural or intuitive combination. And yet across fifth edition D&D, I have met so many people who have played tiefling druids. And it's like this very strange merging of things to me. That's like a seemingly appealing to a lot of people. So I love that little beat. The thing that I really like,
well, do you want to just say what, just in case people don't know what a tiefling is? It's just
Sure. So there's all these different crazy races in Dungeons and Dragons. It's species of people. And tieflings are, they're kind of half human and they are half sort of demonic or devilish. When we talk about incubus and succubus, these are real creatures from the lower planes that may make a bargain with one of your ancestors and they shared a bloodline, and now you're born generations later and you have horns and pointed ears and these kind of inhuman features, oftentimes like a pointed devilish kind of tail. And it's a very kind of this monstrous race. It's big, like Nightcrawler energy from X-Men, if you're familiar with that, right? So so I love the tiefling druid. Look, I would have loved to see her cast spells, but on the other side of it, again, I understand the storytelling aspect here, that they're like, let's not muddy the waters. Let us have, this is the guy who casts spells. This is the person who wild shapes and the crazy animals. This is like one of the big thematic abilities. And so that was cool. What I really loved about Simon, though, as this wild magic sorcerer, wild magic is like this crazy erratic magic, Grace. You play a wild magic sorcerer, and when you cast a spell, sometimes you're just going to roll a 100-sided die. Those are real. They exist. I have one. And you're going to look on this table between 1 and 100, and it's going to come up with a random effect that might make grass grow on all of your companions, or it might drop a fireball on your feet, or it might do all these different crazy
good things. Or bad. It could be great, it could be bad, but you don't know. Something's going to happen.
Pure chaos, exactly. So I do not love this class, Grace. There is so much like variance and craziness there. This is not one of my favorites. I would never play it when they're in my parties. I've had so much kind of PTSD with wild magic sorcerers across the decades. I love the way they turned it into his arc for his character, even though it's like small and not as developed as we get with Edgin and Holga. It was really great, this ability that, like, I don't have full control over my powers, right? And that's like, that's part of his personality. That's part of his lack of confidence in himself, that it's not consistent. He can't count on this stuff to work when he wants it to. It works when it works, and it does different things. And I thought that was a great way to, like, integrate the mechanics into character in a like, very narrative way that I just really found enchanting.
Yeah, I agree. I do think you could have done more with Doric in terms of just keep the stuff that she's doing to be super nature-y. So being able to, like, talk to animals or whatever that thing would be that I think you could have done that's like magic, but maybe doesn't have to feel super magic-y because it feels more nature-y.
At the end for the boat, this is like a druid spell, tidal wave, right? And when I was like, oh, bummer, he's stealing your water spells, druid, you know. We could have definitely done more there, but I get the choice, you know.
I get just to have Simon be the one who's like dealing with magic and then Sophina as the red wizard. What did you make of Sophina the red wizard played by Daisy Head and Hugh Grant as Forge, as our kind of our bad guys in the movie?
I loved this. So, you know, the Hugh Grant casting, again, I go
him
back.
Him as a villain, it's like, it's really working. He's like, he's in Paddington 2. People have not watched that. Great villain in that.
I have not watched Paddington 2, though. Oh,
you're
going to
watch the Paddington movies,
movie.
Rich. Yeah.
I was a big Paddington kid back in the 80s. I loved my little dude there.
You were a bear who wore a little hat and a...
I did. I had the galoshes. Part of what I loved about Hugh Grant's casting, and this is like very idiosyncratic to me specifically, but again, there's these two previous Dungeons & Dragons movies that are out there, and they're bad, you guys. They're very bad. The only thing that is not absolutely terrible about them is that Jeremy Irons plays like this maniacal sorcerer, and he turns the dial up to like 11. He's like chewing the scenery and so over the top, and in a very real way, even visually, the way that like Hugh Grant's character Forge like looked, it was this visual mirror to Jeremy Irons in those other movies. He was so like sort of campy and over the top as like the villain reveal got a little bit further on and we get to the end where he's like threatening the daughter. It really called back to the only redeemable thing about those disastrous old films to me. And I kind of love that. Daisy Head as Sophina, as this red wizard of Fae. Awesome. Yeah, right. Really the red wizards that. Like, you don't need to say that much. Just walk around menacingly. You got the scary head tattoos.
Head tattoos. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was really good. I thought that for as much as I liked some of the shenanigans of the movie, I really liked putting the portal in the painting, putting the painting over it, whatever, then the painting falls over. Like, right.
I think that painting was supposed to be a very famous figure in Forgotten Realms as well, by the name of Volo. There's a guy named Marco Volo who travels
Volo's
the realms.
Volo's Guide to Monsters.
Yeah, that's him.
It's so fun because most of this are like, I have that, but like Mordenkainen Institute, Tomb of Foes. Yeah, I mean, that's me. I did like that stuff. I thought some of that stuff was really fun. I thought that the plot point of like drop the treasure and everyone will leave the, like, I don't know if they just like were like, oh man, we don't have the budget for the city of undead or whatever, but like I really wanted that to happen. Like, I wanted the whole stadium to become undead monsters, and the fact that they all just are like orderly leave while she's like casting the spell on top of the city, I thought that was a little I didn't love that. It felt a little like you could take it out, but I did love all the stuff with Hugh Grant. Other than that, how easily he's able to convince Kira that like her dad is bad, but whatever, that's fine. Like, she's a kid and he's gaslighting her, so that's
she's
fun.
A little kid going through trauma. He's gaslighting. It's all terrible scene. Let it slide.
But he was very fun as a villain, as a sort of a stink. And I, you know, it's so funny, they kind of got me, because I was like, I thought that Hugh Grant was the villain in this movie early on, and then we're watching the replay and he's like, in the party. He's like a rogue with the party. Mm-hmm. And then they did get, they're like, you know, when he reveals himself to have caused the time stop to freeze them, he wanted to kill Simon. Like he wanted to capture them and whatever. I'm like, oh yeah, he is the bad guy in this movie. Yeah,
this definitely. is another fun wink and a nod that like, oh yeah, the rogue. And he's like, yeah, don't trust the con man. You know, the idea that like, you know, once upon a time, especially when we were younger adolescents, played a bunch of D&D, there was always somebody in the group that was secretly evil and was trying to screw us over. And more times, more than a handful of times in my experiences, Grace, did we have one player who would like go the route of Forge and like take this nefarious kind of heel turn early on in the campaign and then quietly kind of conspire with our dungeon master in the background for months until we realized that they were still out there amassing power. We had to kind of like deal with them as a villain. It was a really fun little heel turn and it felt authentic to me to the D&D experience. You know,
see, I think the next one they need to do or the party is there's like somebody who's never played D&D before. They play a rogue and they're like, I try to steal from my own party. The people who are like, yeah, I can do anything. So I'm like, and really like, you know, are finding some catharsis through doing all the bad stuff you're not allowed to do in real life. I believe, I don't love the term, but I believe a hobo.
Oh, a murder hobo?
A murder hobo, that's right.
Yes, murder hoboing, listen, it's a mostly affectionate term that we often designate to new D&D players because there is part of Dungeons & Dragons which is like, I just worked all day. I had to deal with my in-laws. Life's hard. Yeah. Everybody is the boss of me. And now I am a ferocious orc barbarian and I am here to crush skulls, right? And that's what part of what people get joy out of the experience. You know what another little beat that I really loved here was, Grace, that I thought like was easy to overlook? One orc, one dwarf across the entirety of the film. These really traditional fantasy races. You said early on, D&D took so much from Tolkien, so much so that the Tolkien estate really like got very litigious with them early on. And, like,
why they're called halflings and not
exactly,
hobbits.
Exactly. Yeah. So the fact that we did not lean on the traditional fantasy tropes, that there were not elves all over the place and dwarves all over the place and the orcs are the bad guys, it was very human-centric. Humans were like the dominant kind of species that we encountered.
The orc we meet is not super great, but
no, he's not. It's very much stereotyping the orcs, which I felt bad for that.
I actually thought worse. He's like actually tried to like assault will not stand for it.
Well, that's what I mean. He's like a stereotypical bad orc. Like, why couldn't we have had a friendly orc named Nicholas, you know? And then like even the Hercules dwarf, like similarly like dense, getting wrecked by the displacer beast. The displacer beast, one of my all-time favorite D&D monsters. So I love to see that. It's so iconic and kind of singular in that, like, you don't see something like that anywhere else except D&D. But I love this choice to lean in on the Arakocra and the Dragonborn on the kind of Icewind Dale Council.
Pretty much all practical effects, eh?
Did Jonathan you see this? Felt pretty practical.
Jonathan.
Yeah.
Jonathan.
Oh, sorry.
It's so funny. It's such a stupid name. There's a lot of the Dragonborn, as somebody who played a Dragonborn it was very fun to see some Dragonborn hanging around. Yeah, I did like this. They were sort of like we saw Tabaxi
baby
person.
So how funny is this, Grace? Like, you're on the movie podcast. The fact that we meet Yank the Paladin and they're like, oh, he's from Thay, we don't know if we can trust him, oh my gosh, and then he literally does the saving the cat, except it's a cat person. Like,
very
come
good
on.
Very good.
Big applause, movie makers. You know,
so we talk about saying the Paladin, I thought that he was gonna be a full member of the party and he's really not. He turns out to be basically an NPC who joins the party for a bit, which is another classic like D&D thing that happens. It's like, you kind of normally, it's like, I find in my experience, it's normally like a little small guy, you're like, a little like kobold or something, you're like, we got this guy's gonna hang around with us forever. But in this movie, it's the Paladin who can get the helm, hangs out with them for a bit before like being like, all right, later. Yeah,
I did in a certain way. It's very clear he's an NPC as we meet him. He knows everything. He's so composed. He's got it. Look how straight he walks, Grace. Yeah. Right over the rocks.
That's so funny. When he's walking away and they're just like, is he going to turn? Nope, we're going to walk right over the rock. Okay, cool, cool, cool.
They're very much memeing on the old paladin who is like this righteous goody two shoes. Volga being like, you're not very much fun, are you? The other thing I just really want to stop down on that I admire so much, and part of the reason why I mentioned Willow early on, I think Willow plays in this tone of irreverent, very fun and funny amidst like a serious story that's actually got some stakes and some heart. But the relationship between Edgin and Holga being platonic, oh my God, give me more. I just thought that's so refreshing. And this
is something, he has weird lips. So
I guess he kind of does. And she's got a thing for little dudes. The Bradley Cooper cameo, by the way, delightful.
Okay. What was he? What's he supposed to be? Is he a halfling? What is he supposed to be?
So what was his name again? Because his name is similar.
Merriman, I think.
Right, which there is a very famous character in The Hobbit named Barliman Butterbur, who is like the innkeeper of the Prancing Pony. Immediately, the name made me think halfling, but then he's so tiny, Grace.
He's really tiny. About,
like, I've been working in my garden. And I'm like, I think he's a gnome. I think he's supposed to be a gnome.
Okay, all right. I see it.
And we had so many other.
Nods. One thing. Is there a thing? Can my friend? What I was getting art made for my friend, and my friend is a huge Lord of the Rings fan. He plays a halfling in our in our home game, and I was getting art, and so I said, "Like, what's he look like? Do you have a beard?" He's like, "Well, he's a halfling, so I guess." Not. And he's kind of like made, like halflings and hobbits. Like, do they have facial hair?
No.
They have
so right? Listen.
And then he had a Brad. Literally, my friend. I was watching the movie, and I'm like, "Thanks, Andrew. I don't think this is a halfling because he has a beard."
Yes. So gnomes will grow beards. Gnomes are a little bit closer to dwarves, whereas halflings map a little bit closer to elves. In the very traditional, like, I'm gonna actually you, Grace.
I mean,
any elf that's ever been made out there with a beard, like, I'm apoplectic, I'm rolling over in my sleep. Elves don't grow facial hair. This is like a whole thing, and halflings are kind of like that. So I think he was a gnome.
No, the Bradley Cooper cameo, tremendous, very funny. Him and his new beau, like, she comes in and she's exactly like Holga, very funny.
And then at the end, that Holga meets the little person, right? And we get the little bit of a wink and like, a nod.
Yeah, very good. Again, I just think I really, you know, I thought that the movie, it was really, really funny. I think like the whole speak with dead thing got a lot of laughs in the thing, even at the beginning, the like, so like, Jonathan, is he coming? Like, I, you know, I'm doing my whole backstory here. I want to tell the story again. If Jonathan comes, like, very, just like genuinely very funny. And then, yeah, that scene where they resurrect Holga and like the flashbacks of Kira, and she gets called Bug by Holga, and Holga's like basically her mom. Like, it's all so good. It's
Can
so
I
like,
stop
yeah.
down to talk about the bug for a minute too. Yeah. There were two very, there were a bunch. I think that when you have people that play D&D together for a long time, you start to develop all these kind of table patterns. You have your own stuff. And then when you start watching Critical Role or you listen to somebody else talk about their game, you start to identify all these things that are like, that's from my game. That's from my game. That's from my game. So the fact that we open with Edgin literally knitting in the prison cell immediately brought us to our dear friend, Melissa Woodward, who is often knitting while we play Dungeons and Dragons together. And then the second beat, Grace, which was this dragonfly, this turquoise dragonfly continues appearing across the film. For those who know my Twitch channel and are familiar with some of the D&D that Grace and I have played together and put out into the world to be consumed by the public, I run a show that's D&D in space. It's the Spelljammer D&D campaign. And it's literally called Dragonfly. They fly around in a spaceship shaped like a dragonfly. So there were immediately these beats that made it so emotional for me and personal in like this really deeply satisfying way. Like I mentioned it a little bit in that preview section, but the fact that, you know, I kind of set up the PSR D&D campaign and I put it in this particular part of the world with just because of my tastes and my inclinations. And I'm like, oh, the Red Wizards of Fae will be a great antagonist to have as the neighbors for our game for the next few years. And the fact that the Red Wizards were the most prominent thing, like, it got me verklempt, Grace. I got emotional and worked up about all this stuff.
So, yeah, just to the Post Show Recaps Discord game, it'd been running for a while, and I think it was in the summer of 2021, 2022. Which summer did we have a marathon game, Rich?
2021 is when we had the summer of the marathon game, that first year, yes.
The marathon game, and there had been so much stuff about, Thay being, we were closely approximated to Thay, and the whole thing was this battle again for a castle, a hold, sort of in a swamp, and we were fighting a bunch of red wizards. And I did just think it was genuinely so cool that we had had this thing that I was thinking about all the other people in PSR who I had played Dungeons and Dragons with, and fought red wizards. And then I'm watching a red wizard on the screen, create an army of undead, which is a lot of what that thing was about, was going to war is good for Thay because you could just turn the skeletons into skeletons to fight in your army. I thought it was so fun. And I think the thing that I love about the D&D game is whether it's the PSR Discord game or getting to play on your stream or my home game is just I think your point of this movie, I think, encapsulated how fun it can be to just hang out with people for 2 hours. For me, that's what D&D is. I literally was having an awful day yesterday and I knew I was playing D&D and I was I don't know. And then by the end of 3 hour D&D session, I'm okay, I'm really glad I went and played D&D. That's great. It's it is that thing that is so, it's just, it can be so fun. And then also just emotionally tear your heart out. And so I think that the movie encapsulated that so well.
Yep, it really did. I can't overstate how important this silly game has been for the entirety of my life. It is my trade. It's my profession now. And
it's your name.
It is. It's DM Philly. And so many of the friends that I have made, the closest people to me, when I got married, all of my groomsmen, they were my D&D party from when I was 11 years old. So to get to see it celebrated with such joy in such a big way, and then to also see the other half of it, which is that it's getting this good reception. It's able to beat a John Wick movie on its opening weekend, where once upon a time, the Dungeons & Dragons movie was indisputably the worst thing that came out in the year. what I mean? It really, may sound silly, but it means so much to me that I really just love it. And I'm super happy that this is a thing that's out in the world now.
Yeah, same. Well, thanks for coming on to chat about it, Rich. Rich, what else do you got going on? Where can people find you? And you know what? Also, you should, if you want to play D&D run by Rich, you could do that. You could play D&D where Rich is your dungeon master.
You can. I do run private sessions. If you are interested in having me run a session and teaching you or your friends or your family or your kids how to play D&D, I'm available. You can hit me up. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at DM Philly. I'm hanging around in the PSR Discord. Of course, Grace, I'm talking about Dark with you and Ariel every week. That's been one of my favorite podcasts that's going on right now. I love Dungeons & Dragons, but I also love Star Wars, and I've been spending a lot of time in a galaxy far, far away talking about The Mandalorian Season 3 with my Mike Bloom, and then later in the week again with LaTanya and Brendan Fitzpatrick. I am really loving this season, which has been very fun for me as I'm going back into this kind of Star Wars deep dive. And then role-playing games, Grace. PSRPGs is our very own kind of in-house post-show role-playing games, where we use games like Dungeons & Dragons, not always, to use the games to tell stories like Honor Among Thieves that are happening in these familiar worlds of all the TV and the movies that we cover and are talking about here at PSR. So we're in the middle of our Last of Us series, where you and Jess Sterling and our friend Stuart join me to play a game similar to Dungeons and Dragons, though quite different, called Apocalypse World. Part 2 is out right now. You got another part coming at you, but we're going to be tackling The Mandalorian next, and that's been a very delightful way for me to share Dungeons and Dragons and tabletop RPGs with the populace over here at PSR.
I mean, I've been a part of both of them, but I think both of them were very fun, and I encourage
people
to
really
check them
out.
I am also covering Succession as well as Yellow Jackets, doing the immediate recaps for both of those, as well as a deep dive with Dr. Amanda and guests each week, covering Great Expectations with Ariel, which has actually been really good, and people should check it out, despite if you look at the IMDb ratings and it says it's bad. It's actually really good, so check it out.
I'm psyched. I'm so glad to hear that. Cool.
Yeah. You and I covering Dark with Ariel as well, and I'm doing a whole lot more. We'll be back. Actually, it's very next week is a busy week. There's a couple movies that are dropping early because of Easter weekend, but two big movies, the Mario, Super Mario Brothers movie, which Corey B, and actually, I will make sure that in the show notes of this episode, there is a form. We are going to be counting down the top 10 Mario characters of all time with Corey B at the end of that podcast, so make sure you vote on that. We'll also be covering Air, the Nike movie about trying to sign Michael Jordan, and I believe we'll be doing How to Blow Up a Pipeline with Zed and Troy as well. And then there's a bunch of good movies, that Tetris movie, A Good Person, Showing Up, Paint, the Bob Ross Owen Wilson movie, which seems delightfully weird. Someone, I think it was Alex in the Discord, told me that every time I list a bunch of movies that are out that I want to watch, he's like, at least two of them sound fake. the Owen Wilson is Bob Ross movie does come out on April 5th, so should be interesting. So that's what we're doing here on Post Show Recaps Theater. Ariel will of course be back for all of it. So until next time, I'm Ariel. I always mess it up. I just said I'm Ariel. I'm Grace. Ariel is not here. We're Post Show Recaps.